Good morning, Mr. K. Kevin Hebert with you in studio with Kevin. We are live on 102.7 CKMS, Rogers Digital Line 46, worldwide at radiowaterloo.ca, and we're quasi-live on Facebook. Quasi-live because it's really tricky for me to get the video. There we go. Hello, Facebook. It's tricky for me to run the video switches at the same time that I'm talking. So we shall do our best. Hello, world. In studio with Kevin features interviews with guests with topics of interest to me and relevance to the community. And we're going to have a great show today. We're going to start with some music to get us in the mood. Something inspirational from Christina Aguilera. This is Beautiful on In Studio with Kevin on 102.7 CKMS.
Every day is so wonderful, and suddenly it's hard to breathe. Now and then I get insecure from all the pain. I'm so ashamed. I am beautiful no matter what. His words can't bring me down, no, no. So don't you bring me down today. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To all your friends, you're delirious, so consumed. Don't you bring me down today.
And that was Christina Aguilera with Beautiful to take us into a Friday on In Studio with Kevin, right here on Radio Waterloo 102.7 CKMS. Very excited to have in studio with me this afternoon Mr. Jim Estill from Guelph. Jim, good afternoon. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. This is still a relatively new show for me. I do another radio show that I've been doing for a little bit longer, and this morphed out of it. And the more I developed it, I started making a bucket list, and you were one of the people on that bucket list for me. So I'm really excited that you're here. And the opportunity came up in a kind of a neat way, as I find things often do, is I had sort of started this pretty magnanimous list I've got of people one day I'll contact or somehow it'll work. And you were on there, certainly not on the, who I'm trying to think of one that I've contacted. Oh, Kathy Griffin, for instance, she's not responded yet. Anderson Cooper has not responded yet. So there's a few that I'm, you know, they're on the list, but I, you know, realistically am moving on to other folks. You know, I felt more confident that when I got to asking you, I'd have a possibility. But within a short time, you happen to be speaking at a university class up at University of Waterloo a month or two ago. And so I figured, okay, this is my opportunity. It was a great to hear you. It was a really neat setting. I hadn't sat in a university class in quite a while. So that was fun, especially seeing all the younger kids. But I figured, okay, this is my chance to ask you. So from the time I did, within less than 24 hours, you had said you would do it. And within like 2 days, we had the date booked, everything was done. So I'll lead that into a question for you. Is that typically how you typically make and communicate your decisions that quickly?
I do. I actually think it's an entrepreneurial trait that good entrepreneurs have. They make decisions quickly and follow through. And as you know from orchestrating this, I have an awesome assistant who actually does all the work. I just show up where she tells me to show up.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree. That was smooth. I mean, I'll tell you a couple things about it, which you probably know, but it inspires confidence right away because everything, the communication was, you know, doesn't need to be instant, but it was appropriate to the discussion, and it was clear. And you know, if there was follow up, it was always there. So that you're absolutely right. I think that makes your life easier. But I think you do a little bit more than just show up. But I would also agree with you that having somebody that can manage all that for you is pretty incredible. And so that's great. So I'll ask the question that I ask everybody. And I'll preface it sort of the same way. You could make this answer could be the entire show if you'd like. You could certainly shorten it down. Just let's start from birth. So where were you born, basically, and maybe just take us on the path to the degree of detail you'd like, say from birth to university.
So I grew up in Woodstock, Ontario, just down the road here. And so speaking of snow, I love shoveling snow. Maybe I didn't love it so much, but my dad made sure that we shoveled driveways, and then I used that as one of my earlier business to make some extra money. Then I went to the University of Waterloo, took systems design engineering. So that's my life from there. I did start a painting business when I was in high school as well. So that was the first larger, well, it wasn't large, but it still had several employees and, you know,
in high
stuff.
School, like grade 10, grade 11?
Yeah, kind of yeah, okay. Yeah.
Was that in Woodstock?
In Woodstock, yeah.
Wow, okay. And was that a business that you ran, not a full-time basis, but I mean, was it just during the summer?
Oh, it was just summer. It was mostly a summer business, but the advantage of painting is you can do it on the weekends and whatnot. Even when I started my computer business, I painted houses occasionally on weekends because that was sure money for me, right?
Okay.
And to this day, I hate painting houses, but
okay,
because I painted so many of them. Yeah, yeah.
Would you consider yourself pretty good? Like, would you?
It depends on your definition of good. More people fail from perfection than speed, and I tend to be good and fast and neat and polite and show up when I say I'm going to show up, and that in this day and age makes you a good tradesperson. Mm-hmm. So I have great confidence that I could always fall back on being a tradesperson. Show up, take your shoes off when you go in someone's house. Be polite. Clean up after yourself. It's not that difficult.
It isn't, but you're right that those are things that I think they just get, I think, assumed away, because you're right. It's not because people can't do it. It's never a lack of skill. It's a lack of maybe awareness, would you say? Why is that? Because those really shouldn't be fantastic qualities. They are, and they stick out. Why do you think that is?
Well, politeness and courtesy should never be an issue. It shouldn't be an issue.
But it is.
But it is. The other part of it is mostly time management. So many, many people are well-intentioned, but they don't figure out their systems to deal with whatever their volume is. So I don't think my electrician is a bad guy. I just think that he told 12 people he's going to do something for them today. So he's late to my appointment, or else he thought he was going to be able to do something in an hour, and it took him 2 hours, and he didn't count on any buffer time. Like even here, the road coming here was closed. I showed up barely in the nick of time, and your office is a touch hard to find. At the end of the day, it was the buffer time that saved me.
Right.
If I had no buffer time, then I would be late.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's a good point, and I can relate to that as I think about it now. That is something I've included in my travels now too, is just build an extra time for anything. I can certainly think of a few horrible appointments that I've had, and overwhelmingly the issue was, in my case, was I was late, which leads to preparedness goes out the window at that point, because you're dealing with,
well, you're already one step behind and feeling uncomfortable, and there's nothing good about being late.
Yeah, so that's a good point. So those are some pretty good traits. So that was painting in high school, and then the first business was it called EMJ right out of the gate? University.
EMJ Data Systems. So while I was in my fourth year university, I needed a computer to do some circuit board design, mm-hmm. and I got a better deal if I bought two of them. So I bought two and sold one, and then someone needed a printer, so I bought a printer, and then I bought two more computers. And next thing you know, I'm buying and selling computers, hardware, software, peripherals. And that's the first business that I scaled. Mm-hmm. So I grew that to $350 million in sales. I sold it to Synnex, and I ran Synnex from $800 million to $2 billion. And while I was doing the distribution business, I had the ability to look into a lot of other technology businesses. So I invested in a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And I was an advisor, a mentor, board member on a number of tech businesses. The most famous one was BlackBerry. I joined the BlackBerry board before they were public, and I was there
before they were BlackBerry, in fact, right?
It was RIM, motion, yeah, RIM, right? Yeah, it was Research in Motion, yes.
I think
yes.
Locally, we might be the only people nowadays.
Exactly. So I joined, Research in Motion board before they were public, and I sat on that board for 13 years. So I saw them grow from almost nothing to billions of dollars in sales and thousands of employees.
And that was during your time you were still at EMJ then?
I was still at EMJ then. That's correct.
So tell me a bit more. You spoke about scaling, and I mean, I could sort of imagine as best as I can, you know, the very early stages where you're saying you bought a computer, and then, hey, I can sell one, and sort of it takes off. How far in, is it months or years that you sort of said, okay, well, I've got something on my hands here, and I need to, you know, build a system around it? Or did you just start like that, and you've always done that?
I didn't always have good systems, but I... basically, when things became untenable, I said, whoa, wait a minute, I have to solve this. My original way of solving things was just basically to add work ethic to it. So I would beat myself up because, oh, gee, if I just got up 15 minutes earlier and went to bed 15 minutes later and worked 5% harder, and then eventually you can't do that. And right. So then it all comes down to systems. The other thing I did when I was scaling my business is I would look at businesses that were bigger than mine and try to figure out, what is it that I will need to do differently to be a different size business? So when I was doing $10 million in sales, I'd look at companies doing $20 million in sales or $50 million in sales and figure out what would I need to change to do that. And I would also try to find people who were complementary to me to do things which needed to be done, which I wasn't necessarily that strong in.
Let's go back a bit before you got close to even $10 million or $5 million, because I think that's key. I mean, as you've grown and as you know, once each of those are different stratospheres where you're now in smaller and smaller company, it's it's still the minority, but there's a sizable amount of people out there that start a business, that do some type of entrepreneurship. I'd say the vast majority, I don't know the exact numbers you might, but hitting $1 million in sales, I think, is still a milestone that that most entrepreneurs don't hit. Is that a fair number, would you say? And I'm including kind of everybody that just says, hey, I'm going to start a business, whatever that is.
I mean, you are probably right.
Yeah.
The other thing is that there is nothing wrong with owning or running a small business. I have nothing. That is an awesome thing to do. As a matter of fact, sometimes I think it would be a lot easier to run a $500,000 business than to run a $400 million company.
Well, there are certainly different challenges, right? There's plus and minuses. I can speak to some of both, not the $400 million piece, but the smaller business side. I'm curious if you can dive a little deeper into the sort of that period. So, like you said, because you touched something I believe most people that get that far know is, okay, you know what? Yeah, I could do more. You're blessed with some, you know, higher than average energy, higher than average commitment. Okay, let me do more, you know, let me keep going. But you will hit a wall. There is only 24 hours a day and there is only one of you. A lot of people burn out at that point, or they give up, or start making mistakes because their performance drops. You didn't really do that. You figured out somewhere, okay, ahead of time, I don't. So was it, what was it? Yes, was there a moment, or was it just a gradual realization, yeah, this is, if I'm going to do this, I better change?
I guess to some extent you're driven by entrepreneurial fear that you're going to go bankrupt.
Mm, yes.
And entrepreneurial fear that you're not going to eat. Entrepreneurial fear that you're going to fail. And so that fear drove me. And in business, you have to look after three different things. You have to look after sales and marketing, the technical, does the product work, and the business end, can you do it at a profit? And tracking, you know, the finance stuff. And I'm naturally a marketing person, but then I'm not bad at sales. So it's marketing and sales. I'm not the technical end of my business, which is buying and selling. So it was pretty simple, but I'm not necessarily that guy and I'm not the finance guy. So I need to find people to fill in those other places for me.
But you figured that out, it sounds like, kind of quick.
I figured it out fairly early, yes.
But
some of that might have been luck and not deliberate. Like some of it, you just lucked into doing it. Now, one thing I do and have done for years is when I figured out I had a time issue, I studied time management.
Mm-hmm.
And so I even wrote a book on time management. And that was all just basically a compilation of all the other time management stuff I'd read and studied.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the practices I do is track my time, and then I put a little like or dislike next to it. Did I like doing it or did dislike doing it?
Okay.
And then what I find is the things I like doing, I tend to have competitive advantage, and I'm good at those, and I do better at doing those. And the things I dislike doing, often there's someone else who likes doing it and will do it much, much better than me. And so by tracking that, I could get the things off my plate that I didn't necessarily like doing that someone else might like doing better.
Hmm. That's a very good way to look at it. And now we'll jump around a little bit, but I'll take us now to today in your career. You're CEO of Danby.
Yes.
You have been since 2015, which is in Guelph where you live. So that's sort of a, I don't want to call it a local business because it's a decent sized international company, but it's local for you in terms of, you know, you get to commute to work.
That's right.
And are you doing a ton of travel?
I do some travel. I don't do a ton of travel. I travel maybe twice a month, but mostly local.
So, because if I recall from some of the speaking I heard you say, you'd sort of retired prior to assuming the role of Danby?
Yeah, I mean, I had retired and moved to New York for 5 years where I was doing angel and venture capital. And then my dad got sick, so I moved back to Guelph, and I was doing some venture capitals, some boards, stuff like that. And I sat on the board of Danby Appliances, and the CEO resigned, so I said, I could come in and run it for a while. So I started running it for a while, and I said, I miss running a business. I'd like to do this for my next gig. So I thought, that's my next decade of my life. I'll be doing Danby Appliances. And then the ownership group said they wanted me to sell the business, which if you're a CEO, that's one of your roles is to do that. And so I said, well, how much for? And they told me. So I said, great, I'll take it. So I bought the company. So that's my history with Danby Appliances.
That's pretty, you make it sound, I mean, it's all true, and but you make it sound so elegantly simple, I'll say, which is really cool. I really appreciate that. Now, Danby was not public at that time.
No, right? Danby's private company was then, still is a private company.
Okay. And so you're now CEO and happen to own it. So you, I mean, in a way, you've got yourself, you know, a small business, depending on how you define small.
That's correct.
I don't call it small by any stretch. I'm just saying from your
experience. No, I have a small business.
You know, which is
it's smaller really than the one, smaller than Cynix when I was running Cynix.
Yeah. So prior to the CEO resigning, you were on that board. Did you have any thought anywhere in your head that, okay, I might want to do that, or I might want to run a company, or was it really driven the opportunity coming up?
Well, what I had noticed from being an advisor and a board member and an investor is I didn't enjoy it as much as operating a business. So I noticed that, but I actually wasn't sure I would ever have an opportunity to run a business the size that I wanted to run, because I was thinking, okay, great, now I have to start a business. So when I moved back to Guelph, I actually started an SEO and digital marketing company. And then I had the SEO and digital marketing company as well as Danby Appliances. So I merged that company with another local digital marketing company called Traffic Soda. And so I still own part of that company, but Traffic Soda still exists. Mm-hmm. But I had thought that, you know, maybe that would be it, but it's not the scale that I like. And I always look at competitive advantage. What are the things that I'm uniquely capable of doing? And running a business, a $400 million business like Danby, is I'm somewhat uniquely qualified. If I was saying to run a $2 million digital marketing agency, yeah, I mean, that's me and 500 other people in the region would be comparably qualified to run that.
Okay.
So the more you can do something that you're uniquely capable. So I actually believe I can drive Danby to $1 billion in sales. And so that everybody listening doesn't think that I'm just a one-shot wonder, you see.
I highly doubt that if we look at the string of successes that you've had, because to speak on that from my own experience, as a client of yours from EMJ and then on, I recall, I believe, now I could be wrong, but Cynix bought EMJ and then bought Daisy Tech?
No, they had already
bought Daisy Tech?
EMJ bought Daisy Tech. I bought Daisy Tech.
So
I had bought Daisy Tech before then, yeah.
That's right.
So I had already consolidated the supplies business. So I bought Daisy Tech and Azurdi.
Azurdi was the
one.
Okay.
And then merged with Cynix. So then that created almost 50% market share in all toners, all inks, all brands of printers.
But that was a pretty big jump from. I mean, EMJ was definitely like a specialty distributor at the time. Azurdi, Daisy were sort of consumable supplies. And then, but Cynix was a broad line distributor that really at the time when there was Tech Data, Ingram, Cynix was sort of the three of Canada
that
were, you know, of scale. So you sold your company EMJ to Cynix, and then you ran Cynix Canada, which is not the typical necessarily move you see a lot of times. It's the reverse. The acquirer takes over. So you sort of played both roles. You bought companies that you merged. I ran both.
Right. So that was my 5-year stint in a corporate world, essentially, because I was running a very large division for Cynix. But that was part of my criterion for selling EMJ, because I had high loyalty to my staff and wanted to make sure that things worked out for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they might argue they did or didn't. But at the end of the day, with me running Cynix, you know, I didn't shut down Guelph. Cynix is still in Guelph, where if you just sold it and walked away, there'd be an equal probability that they just say, oh, okay, great, we'll just move everybody to Toronto and, you know, and whatnot. And I worked with these people for 25 years. I felt loyalty to my staff. And I did want the opportunity to run a bigger show. So that also was fun and interesting.
And I sense, anyways, at least for myself, but I think I was reading it a bit on your face, the dichotomy of what you were describing is probably so innate, so natural to you, of I want to be loyal to my staff, as if what other thing would you do? But I can also tell you how unique that is, and it's relatively uncommon out there. And I think that's another sort of unique trait of gyms, or rare. A lot of companies can't or don't do that when they sell. And again, from the other side of all that, I remember, all these companies had warehouses all over the country, but Cinex ended up with a competitive advantage because it was actually the only one for many years, and probably still is, that had their warehouse not sort of right in the Toronto core, which isn't always that advantageous. They're horrible to get to, whereas Guelph is actually, for local people to get to, it's great. Guelph is like a small town compared to Toronto.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Guelph was a competitive advantage for EMJ, and we left it as we made it a competitive advantage for Cinex, because basically Cinex has lower overhead. And Cinex, while I was with Cinex, we bought that 620,000 square foot facility on Woodlawn Road from Imperial Tobacco, which was a gorgeous building. And Imperial Tobacco had tons of money and had put hundreds of thousands of dollars into renovating and getting it up. And it's like, it's 7 indoor loading doors, parking for 1500 cars. I can't, 130 video cameras. Like, it was just such a gorgeous facility, and we paid less to buy the building than competitors were paying for rent in 2 years in Toronto.
Wow. Yeah.
And so your overheads are just way lower. And of course, the other problem is I always, for some reason, choose competitive businesses, and that business is a competitive low margin business. So you have to be very cost conscious. Mm-hmm. And that's been one of my other hallmarks, is I'm a very frugal guy, just because I pick competitive businesses. Maybe I should pick a business that's high margin next time.
I'm sure when you started, it was.
Well, when I started, margins were higher, and margins declined every single year that I've been in business. So margins just kept on going down. Yeah. Margins went down every single year. Yeah.
Let's play a song now. You put me sort of on. Didn't put me on the spot. I'm not gonna put it that way. But I tried a few different ways to get some musical direction from your assistant, and eventually all she gave me was, Jim's not a huge fan of heavy metal and rap now, which is totally cool. My other show focuses mostly on heavy metal. But I said, okay, I can go a couple routes here. I could completely ignore it and go, well, that's nice, and just play what I want. I toyed with the idea of trying to convert you. So I thought I would play with some songs that really might fall under heavy metal, but that probably you'd like because they don't sound like that. But then I went a whole other route, and I picked mostly local artists. So I've got a few different local ones. I'm going to play this. I think I'll just give a quick story to it. So it's Hildegard von Smoochie, and I love the story, because here at the station we get submissions all the time. CKMS is a community radio station. But it's probably the same across. In fact, we may get more than commercial stations, because we tend to be more open to unsolicited, contributions. So we're literally inundated by everybody, which is great. I look for stuff that's just different, that sticks out. And I remember an email coming from this young lady. She's from Ontario. So Hildegard von Smoochie is her artist name. But she sent the email and said, here, I'm in my 40s or hit 40, and it's always been on my list to write music. So I decided one day I'm going to write 5 songs in 5 days and record them. Here they are. I thought, well, that, you know, that took something to do. So I'm going to listen to it. So this is one of those songs, Hildegard von Smoochie in studio with Kevin, with Jim Estill. This is It's All Woo Woo.
It's all woo, 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 woo. Put a foot in your shaman shoe. It's all woo, 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 woo. Got a hollow bone to pick with you. It's all woo, 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 woo. Look at us from a bird's eye view. It's all woo, 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 woo. Drive that rainbow into your brain stew. It's all woo, woo, woo. Remember to balance your canoe. It's all woo, woo, woo. Ride your drum, your new tattoo. It's all woo, 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 woo. Since then I feel brand new. Thank you for your woo, 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 woo. Wish it works, it's really true. Thanks again for the woo, 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 woo.
And we're back. That was Hildegard von Smoochie. It's all woo-woo. You're listening to 102.7 CKMS. You can hear us on the FM dial locally on Rogers Digital 946, worldwide at radiowaterloo.ca/listen. A couple notes for those of you looking for stuff to do in the region. Tomorrow night at the Boathouse in Victoria Park, Grabert is playing, Cambridge duo. And our very own Robot Apocalypse is playing also at the Boathouse next Friday, March 16th. That's a free show. So get out there and support Robot Apocalypse. That's their first show since the release of their album, which is also going to be the soundtrack to the Radio Waterloo documentary that is coming out sometime in 2018. We are in studio with Mr. Jim Estill. Jim, what'd you think of that song?
That was actually a good choice.
Yeah?
That's a good choice.
Awesome. Yeah, that, like I said, that's a, that was a, that, it, it's a fun song. I quite like it. It's one of the fun things since I started doing radio that you just never know. I just sometimes go through emails and something grabs me. I've made a really cool friend out in New Brunswick, very same way, just whatever the email, there was something about it, caught my eye, started talking to him. Turns out, you know, he's got like 8 CDs he's recorded strictly for his own pleasure. He records them. He makes all his music available to download for free. And, you know, not quite sure how he makes a living, but it's not with his music. He's not looking to make money with that. But it's, you know, it's really something to see people sort of just go off like that. So let's go back to Danby just a little bit, because I know Danby from, it's not a new company. Danby's been around
Danby was started in 1947.
And I knew them, a good friend of mine, one of my best friends, I think was at least the first I remember. He had a Danby fridge in his little apartment when we were in our early 20s. And
yeah,
it was just known as the beer fridge. That's, I think, what Danby might have been known for for college students.
That's correct. Yeah.
Anybody of drinking age, of course. But you've got a couple new products out. One I've seen. Now, the other one that I know about, I haven't seen. I don't know if it's out, but tell us about the herb garden one.
Well, as you know, I'm an environment guy like you are. Mm-hmm. And so I hate waste and throwing things away. So I looked at what is it that does get thrown away, which is not thrown away. It does get recycled, but not reused, and reuse is a much better use. So we would have some wine coolers, which would come back, and these are basically look like glass door refrigerators. Mm-hmm. And so I said to myself, well, what can that be used for? And I'm a gardener. And I said, well, that's going to be a much neater solution than hanging grow lights over a shelf on a, and doing it that way. So we converted them into herb grower units. And then we sold enough of them that we decided to produce them, because I didn't have enough dead wine coolers to reuse. And so that's the product. And it's really good with wheatgrass. I'm a health guy also. So mm-hmm. It's really good with wheatgrass. Wheatgrass grows really fast, but it grows, you know, parsley, cilantro, basil, anything you want. And this time of year, it's good for starting tomatoes or whatever you want to start. So it's like your own little, very neat little greenhouse with the grow lights. And
it's all like it's a ready to go system. You buy
it. Yeah, it's ready to go. You plug it in and go. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And now what about the other product?
Well, I'm not sure which product you're talking about, but I have lots of I have lots of products.
Well, tell me about all of them. All the unreleased stuff.
So the unreleased. Well, we redefine the company. So rather than saying we're an appliance company, we say that we're a company that makes big boxes.
Okay.
And then you look at, there's a lot of deliveries being made on Amazon and other .com deliveries. Everyone's getting, remember, there's 15 billion parcels a year delivered.
How many?
15 billion parcels
that's
a year.
Like a worldwide number, or North America?
That's North America. So and it's growing by 3 billion parcels a year. So it's a massive, massive market.
Yeah.
And so the solution is a parcel mailbox, where the parcel doesn't sit on your front porch. It goes in the parcel mailbox, and we're coming up with one that's IoT. So it's connected to the internet. It has a camera, IP camera, so you can see who dropped it off. You can get emailed or text when someone's dropped something off. It's got a mm-hmm. car alarm, so if someone moves it. So we're getting into the parcel mailbox business. And I actually believe that that is one way that we will double our business. And I can speak freely, because you can go and open a parcel mailbox company if you want, but you don't have the I always look at competitive advantage. You don't have the competitive advantage that we have, because I happen to know making metal boxes is kind of a lot of work, and you don't have the facilities to do that, and distributing them, and or the channel. So that's another thing which I think will be huge. Herb growers, I fully realize, is a niche market.
Yeah.
Like, not everybody wants to grow their own herbs.
Right.
And
but you saw an opportunity, like you said, from, you know, and it, really that's an advantage that you had that nobody else has, or very few other people are going to have too many unused wine or returned wine cooler boxes that are sort of ready made to go.
Which is competitive advantage. And then that's the other thing I pride myself on, is I am pretty creative. Mm-hmm. So or some people call it eccentric. So I tend to think of things a little differently than what some other people would do. But that's just merging my interest in gardening, my mm-hmm. interest in health, my interest in not wasting from the environment. Now we're making them, so now I don't have the same environmental footprint advantage. But
no, but that's what got you there. You wouldn't have done it.
I wouldn't. I probably wouldn't have done it if I.
Because mm-hmm. it is. I mean, if you just look at it in a very traditional linear way,
right?
And make fridges. I'm going to make herb growing things. Not necessarily an obvious sort of link.
Well, and it's sort of the same as parcel mailbox. I'm sitting mm-hmm. there saying, well, what can we make? Well, a parcel mailbox is a big metal box. We happen to make freezers, which are big metal boxes. We happen to know how to move big metal boxes. Well, so this is a big metal box. And we'll probably come up with plastic versions too, because you have to think of yourself as a big box company. And we'll do it as a family, just like we do with our refrigerator. So we've got, you know, tiny refrigerators, mm-hmm. medium size. We don't go full size, but we've got, you know, 18 different stainless steel, white, black, red. You know, we've got all kinds of different sizes, with a freezer, without a freezer, with features or not, right? So
when is that guy coming out?
The parcel mailbox will be out in less than a month.
Okay.
But the one with the IP camera will probably be July.
Okay, so it's pretty imminent.
Oh yeah.
And we may as well promote your channel as much as we can. If I'm in Kitchener, Waterloo region as an example. I know you have the outlet store and you have an online store, but ideally, should folks be going, where should they go to get Danby stuff?
I mean, we sell through most appliance outlets, like TA Appliance is a big one in the region.
Okay.
But we also sell through places like Costco and Home Depot.
Okay.
So we sell through mass merchants as well.
Right. Okay.
And in our outlet store, I'm not actually trying to compete with those stores. It just is you do get returns from places and you do end up with some damaged or one-off products. So even when we're developing a herb grower, we make 10 different versions, one with the, you know, the lights 1 inch from the top and one with a thermostat on the side, you know, like you do different things. Well, I'm not going to throw those away. I sell them. It just means you can buy a herb grower that has a rounded handle when everybody else's has the square handle, because right. that's the one we standardized on after we went out and asked a bunch of people which ones they preferred.
Right. So your outlet store is
I call it you get a one of a kind. You see?
Yeah.
I should charge more for it.
I was going to say, but plus, not only is it less expensive, you're saving the environment, and it's a unique product. So, well, I don't know. Maybe you'll go back, and it won't be less expensive. I think outlet stores. You used in that manner, you're right. You don't want to be competing with your own channel. That's an IT companies prefer to do that. But not that cynics did. I'm talking about the manufacturers. But that's another discussion. And I was going to veer off into when you were talking about big metal boxes. I was going to ask you where you get your steel. But then that might land us into some political discussion.
That's right. And I don't do politics. Just like I don't do music, I don't do politics. Exactly. How's that?
So we love everybody. That's not what you said. I realize. Yeah, I'm taking that out of context. He said, "No, we're not here to talk about politics." That's very fair. But you talked now. Well, because I want to tie this into a couple different things. Well, and I think I want to get a song in before we get to the line. Well, maybe not, because I really want to spend some time on this next topic. So very quickly, tell me if this is your favorite or if there's another one. But this was what I wrote down of your mantras, if I can call them that. Fail often, fail cheap, and fail fast.
Yes, fail often, fail fast, fail cheap. Yes, that's one of the things. And having a failure does not make you a failure.
Right.
So it's partly around accepting that failure moves you forward and not beating yourself up for it. And in a company context, creating a company that accepts failure. Because
yeah.
I could zap people for, and especially when you're doing new product, I could zap people for, not for doing something wrong, but
sure.
you can't zap people for doing something wrong because otherwise you won't do anything right because you won't even try things.
That's the biggest one, and you do see that in a lot of places. I mean, that came to mind as I was listening to your herb growing development. Maybe that wouldn't have worked out. You may have gotten so
Totally. Right? Absolutely.
Maybe not cost effective. Maybe whatever way you do it, people don't like it. Who knows? But you try it and it works. You proceed. It doesn't work. You move on. But like you said, you create an opportunity that people aren't, you know, whoever put the thermostat wherever it turns out people don't like it. Hopefully they're not in the corner feeling ridiculed because their idea isn't on the final product. They're feeling
right.
Like, hey, great, you tried. You helped get us to where we got. And
yeah.
That's a huge difference. I mean, I'm getting literally, I get goosebumps when I, right now, which tells me that I'm, you know, it's resonating for me. So the next thing I want to talk to you about, of course, is Syria. You've been in the news, well, for me, because I was in the IT field and I followed everything. So for a while, you know, Jim Estill woke up this morning. Could be if it was a, you know, computer dealer news was looking for a slow story, slow week, that could have made it. I'm sure you've had, you know, you know what I mean. But you hit the real, you know, the mainstream news and internationally with Syria, particularly around your private sponsorship of Syrian refugees. Before we talk in specifically about it, was there like a moment where you said, I'm going to do something?
You know, there was not one moment. It was just a buildup. Like I could feel something happen. You know, I could see what was going on. Entrepreneurs are impatient. So I was impatient. Things weren't happening fast enough. And what was my small part? What was the little piece that I could do? So I decided that's what I'd do is do my small part.
So, and initially was you
I was going to bring in 50 families.
So it wasn't, you didn't, sponsor one and say, okay, let me see. You said I'm going to bring 50.
Yeah, and I didn't think it was that big a deal because I said, oh, Guelph population 130,000 people. How many is absorbable? I mean, there's a financial thing as well. I have a charitable budget that I spend, and so I just did the math and I thought, yeah, that's doable. So that's why I thought I'd bring in 50 families. We brought in 58 families so far, and I have a few more coming. I think four more slated to come in. But that was my Syrian project.
Mm-hmm. And this started two years ago? Or is it a little?
It's not quite 2 years ago. So it'd be, 20 months ago, roughly.
And I know when it started to get sort of recognition in the media, were you concerned that there might be backlash from a Danby perspective, or was it that there was a little bit of sort of friction that caused you to say, oh, I didn't think people would react this way?
I guess I knew there could be some friction. Anything you do that's slightly controversial, people can cause some friction. But one of the things I always say is do the right thing. So so having a little bit of pushback doesn't cause me to not do the right thing. And to some extent, in situations like refugee, when you need leaders to stand up, because leaders stand up and say things, then people will follow them. Mm-hmm. And there's 20-30% of people that are on the fence.
Mm-hmm.
And I could get up and say, this is bad. And then they'd all say, oh, this is bad. Or I could get up and say, this is good. And they say, oh yeah, well, Jim says it must be good. So yeah. My goal actually changed from just helping these 50 Syrian refugees to helping or inspiring other people to do the right thing, inspiring other people to help with this. And that was mostly because the press seemed to go wild over this, which I was very surprised by. I had no idea that it was that big a deal, but
looking back, are you still surprised even today, or do you sort of see?
Well, I guess I see the why. The news, it was very topical in the news at the time. So it was topical, but on a donations and charity basis, it's not any bigger than any other things that many, many other people have done or that I've done for other things. And those don't even make they don't even make the news, or it's just a plaque on the hospital wall, right?
Right. Nobody's writing stories and nobody's commenting to either support you or question you for it. But
that's correct. And most of the negative is in anonymous commenters. So it's all the doubters are all anonymous, and the real people, supporters are real people. And in the end, it is what it is.
Right.
And my other thing is, Canada always rejects the current wave of immigrants. So there was a time when we rejected the Italians. You don't want an Italian living next door, and then you don't want an Irish living next door, and then you don't want a Roman Catholic, and then you don't want Jews, and then you don't want Vietnamese boat people more recently. Hungarians, when they came in, one of the biggest business owners in Guelph, Frank Hasenfratz, was a Hungarian refugee. He's got 10,000 employees now in Guelph. Maybe it's only 8,000. Doesn't matter. It's a lot of employees.
Yeah.
So when anyone ever says, oh, this is a bad thing, I say, oh, yeah, we should get rid of all refugees. We should kick Linamar out. I mean, I'm sure those 10,000 people can get another job. Like, what's the big deal? We should get rid of them all, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, it takes – well, like you said, it does take somebody to stand up and counter some of that, because there's a lot of – I'd say uninformed opinions maybe would be the best way to put it.
And a decade or two from now, people will forget it, and people will just be normal people. Because when I was even making the decision, I walked through my office, and it's kind of multicultural.
Right.
And I don't even think of it. Oh, that guy's Chinese. Oh, that guy's from Pakistan. Oh, he's from India. Oh, he's from Brazil, he's from Mexico. I mean, it's very multicultural anyways. And of course, I have many people working for me who are multicultural, but if you talk to them, you couldn't tell because their parents are Korean. They're as Canadian as you are.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's it's definitely something. Now, you actually changed the logo, the slogan of Danby.
Yeah, I changed the tagline to do the right thing.
And what was that, before, after, during?
That was during, okay. And so, I did so that.
Was it partially driven by, not specific, but that was part of the movement?
Partly driven by that. I had always said that in business, so I had used that before I did Danby Appliances. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's actually a good way to run a business, because you can't possibly have a rule book for every eventuality.
Right.
And so what you do is you say, well, do the right thing. How do you treat your coworkers? Do the right thing. How do you treat your customers? Do the right thing. Do you ship products that don't work? No, you do the right thing. How do you treat your suppliers? Do the right thing. And you could even say you do the right thing because you're doing it for the world, or in business, you do the right thing because it kind of helps you too. Like, if I treat you well as a customer, then you tell all your friends to buy from me, and if I treat you, if I don't do the right thing, then that has repercussions also. So it's a good way to run a business.
Mm-hmm. Which is, again, incredible to me. It's commendable that you do it, and it's obvious in everything you do, but it's equally, it doesn't cease to amaze me though how that still is a competitive advantage, that you would just think, well, that is something I think more people could just do, is just do the right thing, approach that, use that philosophy, but it's not as common as you'd think in business, right? Even the fact what you mentioned, that you're not doing it strictly because you're a nice guy and you just want to be altruistic. You're doing it for bottom line reasons. But
I think people want to work for a company that does the right thing. Like, you don't want to work for a company that says, "Oh, let's just short all the customers," or let's short the suppliers. No, I mean, you want to have a reputation that I can call a supplier. I can call many, many, many people today, mm-hmm. and do $1 million or $10 million deal on the phone.
Right.
Based on the fact that they know it. I said I'd pay for it, and I'll pay for it because that's what the deal is. And,
mm-hmm. Your reputation is built on all those things. Right. So two other quick things that sort of tie in. Do you want to talk about, do you want to talk about housing at all? Affordable housing?
Because I did the Syrian thing, I got in touch with the housing market in mm-hmm. Guelph.
And you were helping, I mean, just maybe for folks that might not know, sponsoring a Syrian refugee family doesn't mean you arranged for them to come over and then that's it. There's a lot more to it in terms of getting them to a sustainable point.
Yeah, you're responsible for moving them into a townhouse, apartment, house, and furnishing it, and giving them their housewares and towels and sheets and everything. So you've got everything, but you need to know. So you basically go into the rental market, and the rental market in Guelph is extremely tight. So I actually had a solution, because I'm a creative guy, and that is. Guelph should loan people money to put basement apartments in their houses, because by nature, those will be affordable. It's not subsidy. You can add it to the taxes. It's win, win, win. So it's just one of those crazy ideas that just seemed logical, mm-hmm. because probably about 5 or 6 years ago, they changed the fire code that has to be a firewall separation between units. And so many basement apartments got shut down during that time. And that takes a supply off the market. Now, of course, I have to be very careful what I say, because the landlords listening are going to be the ones building the big developments. To some extent, I cut into their market if they would do that. But Guelph could easily add 2,000 or 3,000auxiliary apartments, mm-hmm. which would, and it's also very good for the environment, because you're already heating your basement. You are not building on green space. Right. You don't need more infrastructure, because your house was designed to have the sewage and water for 6 or 8 people, and you've got 2 people living there.
Yeah.
And that what's happened is we've created less density in our cities, and everyone thinks, oh yeah, everybody's entitled to a 80-foot lot or 50-foot lot, and we'll just build over this green space. So it's an environmental thing, it's an affordable housing thing, and it's also good for the middle class, that if we did 3,000 units, it's 3,000 middle-class people who can afford to stay in their home or they generate some income. So it was, that was just my win-win idea.
Well, and it, you know, it's talking about it, we'll get somebody it resurrected. Because I think, I don't know, I'm in Cambridge, we, you know, here in Kitchener-Waterloo. I'm not sure if the bylaws are particularly different. They tend to lockstep.
No, that's a building code, so it's absolutely the same in Cambridge.
Oh, okay.
That's building code.
So
on the firewall,
the firewall
separate.
Is a building code.
Firewall is Ontario building code.
But I mean,
and the unintended consequence was it just took a lot of units off the market.
Now, could a municipality put an exemption in?
No, I don't. Well, I do not. Now I'm getting in over my head, I don't know. And I'm not advocating exempting. I'm just saying help people financially do it. And the cities can do it because they're allowed to loan money to people, and they're allowed to attach to your taxes. And taxes get paid before your mortgage, before the bank. So, so the city can do it with no risk at all. The city can borrow an unlimited amount of money at virtually no interest. It can be highly profitable for the city because if you put a basement apartment and they can charge you $500 more taxes and and the city cost does not go up because they don't need new infrastructure to put you in there. I know that there's policing and stuff like that, but on your cost of for the city per house is lower than putting up a new apartment building.
And another positive ramification of that as well is that you had mentioned at some point was better integration too of folks because
adding
a family into an existing neighborhood where people can support them and it's not 5,000 new people in one block.
Right.
Have to figure themselves out.
It creates an integrated neighborhood, which is why you'll get pushback because some people think that we should separate socioeconomic classes. And I get it.
Yeah. That's that'll be for one of my more controversial shows. I'll get myself all wound up. We are, believe it or not, already at 128, which is amazing. I've got lots to. I'm not going to cram important topics into 2 minutes. But is there anything else, Jim? Anything you want to talk about that we didn't touch on?
I think we've pretty well touched on it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Just quickly, can I promote your blog?
Sure. Yeah. www.jimestill.com. That's JIMESTILL.com.
I have a whole story there. We won't get into other than this piece here. So is this date, maybe I've given it away now, but Tuesday, May 17th, 2005.
Yeah. Is that the date I started it? Probably.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the date I started it. Yeah.
It's almost 20. Well, it's 13. You're coming up on a 13th year anniversary of blogging.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Now you don't do this every day religiously, but
oh heavens no. No, I don't. I drop back a lot on it, but I started originally as a communication method with my new Cynics employees.
Okay.
So I always try to figure out how to solve problems, and I'm also an early adopter of technology and blogs were just new. So I said, what's this blog all about? Figure that out. And so that's why I did that.
It's incredible because I remember again many years ago going on it, I followed it for a little while, then I dropped off, but I certainly went back on just today, and you posted as recently as a couple of weeks ago, so maybe we'll finish off with that book. So you mentioned the book, I just want to refresh us here, The Beauty of Discomfort was a book you read.
Oh yeah,
so
Amanda Lang's
book. 30 seconds, what's the story there?
Well, the gist of The Beauty of Discomfort is you only grow and learn if you become uncomfortable, and becoming uncomfortable is not necessarily something we should avoid. Matter of fact, that's why a lot of people are overweight, because they won't be uncomfortable, right?
That's fair, yes. All right, that takes us to 1:30. Thanks very much, Jim. This has been In Studio with Kevin on CKMS 102.7 Radio Waterloo.